Have Al Gore and you have Lieberman running around the country, Lieberman saying freedom of religion doesn't mean freedom from religion. You've got them talking about family values, you've got them talking about censorship, you've got them lecturing Hollywood. In other words, you've got a lot of what the Christian Coalition was on about, on the Democratic Party ticket. That is the pattern, that's the way it works. Gore, I think, was picked for the ticket in 92 because Bill felt that he needed a man who had worn a uniform by his side, because Gore had in 1990 voted for the war in Iraq, and they needed that in 1992. So Gore could go around the country saying, I voted for the war, and now I say to George Bush, why didn't you get rid of Saddam Hussein? That was his function. He came into the White House as what has been later described as the most powerful vice president in history. And it's got some substance to it as a boast. It's clear that Gore did have very great responsibility. He had responsibility for the environment. Bill was not bigger for the environment, as you might easily imagine. He liked nature when you could see it through the golden arches of McDonald's, you know. Gore had responsibility for reinventing government. Now, not much. It's a great journalistic gap. If you go back and try and find good coverage of reinventing government, you will barely find anything. Why? Another classic example of the bait and switch. Now, some of you may remember in Reagan and Bush time, Reagan came to Washington saying, I'm going to cut the civil service back. I'm going to get rid of the federal bureaucrats. I'm going to dispose of troublesome regulation. They set up something called the Grace Commission. Bush said the same thing. We're going to just take an axe and we're going to cut the red tape away. They set up the Council on Competitiveness. And they put Dan Quayle in charge of it. The Clinton-Gore crowd got in. Gore was put in charge of reinventing government. He made a great show. He said, I'm now dissolving the Council on Competitiveness. No more will we have these intolerable threats to government. And then he proceeded to do everything that Reagan and Bush could not do. He finally, if you were following the debate and you hadn't actually fallen into refreshing sleep, for which I wouldn't blame you, Gore finally the other night, when Bush was going at him about being a guy for big government, he said, he kind of mumbled it actually, I got rid of 300,000 federal employees. He did. He's not like to say it too loud, but he got in and they cut not only 300,000 jobs, they privatized them or they just got rid of them. They threw out merit protections. They threw out regulations which were designed, like in the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board. They cut the budget by about 30%. They cut back enforcement. They cut back enforcement in OSHA, in EPA. They removed what pathetic amounts of surveillance were possible in the Pentagon. In other words, they did everything the Reaganites had hoped to do. In the book, we quote Blacks in Government, an organization of African-American federal employees. They use the phrase economic genocide to describe what Gore did to government under reinventing government. And just as an example of how reality is so very different from these political charades that you watch, when you see Gore shouting at Bush or Lieberman shouting at Bush about the environmental standards of Texas, which are not high, as anyone who's ever driven through Port Arthur will know very well, they're able to get away with it legally because under reinventing government, the EPA pushed back the deadlines on fulfilling the Clean Air Act. Why? Because the Michigan delegation said, ask Gore to do so. That's why Texas can get away with it. Stuff that Gore did back in the early 90s. Gore also had big responsibilities in the field of foreign policy. Bill, you'll remember, was not big for foreign policy. He wanted to get on with his domestic agenda. We'll come to that in a minute. When we went back and looked at the record, you can find that Gore was the leading advocate of the bombing of Yugoslavia and the guy who superintended the great war crime of the Clinton-Gore years, the sanctions on Iraq, which have now, on some estimates, killed about 1 million Iraqi kids. He's the guy who oversaw it, who is overseeing it. These embargoes, as we all know, are the most lethal forms of war. They go on and on and on. Now it's come out, of course, that they deliberately targeted all the sewage treatment plants at the start of the bombing. It's a, by the way, under war crime laws, that's a war crime. War on civilians. They knew perfectly well what was going to happen. They knew the water was going to turn into sewage, that kids would be forced to drink it, that old people would die, that kids would die. They knew exactly what they were doing. And they know exactly what they're doing now when they won't let the Iraqis import compressors, they won't let them import medical devices of one sort or another. And they know the whole thing. And Gore has been at the top of that. I'm not sure he was actually in the lead on the program to get $1 billion to Colombia, but he's been supportive of it. When you're looking at him, you are looking at the interventionist, heartless foreign policy of the Clinton-Gore years and one of its leading executives. People say now, when they're doing the either-or routine, the lesser of two evils, they put those questions to people, and you'll say, well, what happened in 1992? You voted for the lesser of two evils, and you got the same old evil. In 1996, you voted for Clinton again, not to have Dole. You got Dole. You wasted your vote. Remember that the Clinton administration, as an effective agent of social change, was done, cooked, and finished by May of 1993. It was all over. Why? The bond industry had said, and if you read Bob Woodward's book on the early Clinton years, it's a pretty interesting book. He has Clinton shouting, in the spring of 1993, you mean all my programs are held ransom by a bunch of fucking bond traders. His words, not mine. And they were. It was all over. Health plan gone, everything gone. And who wrote out the press release announcing that David Gergen, an old Reagan Bush man, was coming in to clean things up at the White House? Al Gore. Who was the person when that welfare bill went through who put the last argument? All the accounts agree, when they came to consider that Republican bill, the entire cabinet was against it. People like Robert Rubin, the Secretary of the Treasury, the bond trader himself, they all said, this is too much, this is too vicious. Gore didn't say anything. Then three men went into the Oval Office, Clinton, Gore, and Panetta, who was Clinton's chief of staff. At this point, Gore made a long argument for Clinton signing the welfare bill. And Clinton did. Not to say that he wouldn't have signed it if Gore hadn't been there, but Gore certainly did that and pushed it through. That's what you've got. When people now are talking about, you know, the possibility of progress, the better complexion of a Gore-Lieberman administration over a Bush administration, what evidence can they produce? What past record have they got? Their record is all used up. You just have to look back across 8 years. What have you got? You've got the crime bill, the drug war, the welfare bill, the embargo on Iraq, increased military spending now promised for the future. What have you got to look at? Oh, the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court. Gore, who has supported vicious crime legislation of the Clinton-Gore years, Gore is suddenly going to reach into some unknown recess of radicalism in his body and nominate William Douglas. I don't think so. You know, when you look at the Supreme Court in the post-war period, you cannot, as a practical matter, predict how these judges turn out. You just can't. Truman appointed the four worst justices of the post-war period, a Democrat. Eisenhower put in Brennan, the best, or one of the best, and Warren. Nixon put in Blackmun, who actually wrote the Roe v. Wade decision. Ford, our greatest president, as I always say. No. Ford, with Cheney at his elbow, put in probably the most liberal justice on the bench, Stevens. Bush put in Thomas, it's true. And he put in Souter, who's the other great liberal on the bench. You know what the vote was for Scalia, by the way, in the Senate? 98-0. We all voted for him. Two Republicans were absent. Who made big speeches for Thomas saying, the guy's got a keen legal mind, his jurisprudence is beyond reproach? Gore and Lieberman, though they did actually both vote against him. Though Lieberman said he did not believe Anita Hill. Now we're being asked to believe that Gore, the most cautious politician on the planet, will suddenly nominate a decent justice, someone who will get past Orrin Hatch, assuming that Republicans hold the Senate. I don't think so. I think he will try and choose someone who obviously, by the way, I missed out one. The justice who wrote the big opinion against Roe v. Wade was appointed by Kennedy, who is a white, just to make the record clear. Do we think Bush will declare political suicide for the Republicans by putting in a justice who will put down Roe v. Wade? I don't think so. I can't prove it. It's true. I think to put all our politics in hock to a hypothesis about the Supreme Court is insane. And what it comes to really ultimately is what you think political movements do. You know, the Supreme Court in the early 70s, but put through Roe v. Wade, if you want to make Roe v. Wade your benchmark for all political thought, the Supreme Court that did that wasn't suddenly, by accident and coincidence, composed of enlightened individuals. What was it doing? The Supreme Court, which is essentially a reactionary institution throughout American history, was responding to political movement, the women's movement. The same way that the Congress that put through the Civil Rights Act in the 60s was responding to a movement. These institutions move when they are pushed. It is the height of elitist liberalism to think we must have a decent judge and she'll fix it up. And it'll be okay. That Gore might do the right thing despite every iota of evidence that says he won't. He will always do the wrong thing. That there'll be a justice who will suddenly make it okay. No. What has to be done now, and we've got some very dangerous, tumultuous, and exciting times ahead of us. We all know that the speculative boom of the last 8 years is not going to last. We all know that that boom did not make the bottom third of the population better off, not even the better half better off, it made the top tenth insanely better off. We know that when the downturn comes, which it will, millions of people now have nothing, nothing between them and the bottom. If there's not a mass movement in the building, in the ready to put pressure, to push Congress, to act, to mobilize the people, we will have nothing. If there's not a movement now that says to Democrats and Republicans, to Democrats, you know what happened in the year 2000. You took things for granted. What a big mistake. Don't ever take things for granted. We are a presence, we are an institutional presence on the American landscape. We have missed many chances since the Vietnam War to build an enduring third presence in American politics. Jackson, to his great credit, built up the rainbow in the late 80s. There was a possibility in the 70s. Here we are in the year 2000. Here we are looking at two candidates who are like two peas in a pod. All they've done in those debates is prove that they're virtually identical. And here we have not just one of the great reformers of American history, but also a strong and growing movement. A movement that could fight in the streets of Seattle. A movement that can create coalitions. A movement of Greens. A movement of people in the labor movement. That is a movement that must not be ignored, that could not ignore its moment of possibility. On the one hand, you have the politics of fear, lesser of two evils. Let's be prudent. Let's try it with Gore. Or you have the politics of hope, where you say, we have, it is our duty, our historical duty to create and give this movement power. And that's the only thing that these institutions will understand is power. And that's the opportunity that awaits us this fall. Thank you.